800, something like that. Well, I talked to the publicity person today, and she's pretty confident it's going to sell out. I don't know if that's the case or not, but it would not be a bad idea to get there by 7:30 or something so you can get a decent seat. General admission, no reserve seating. What'd you say? The bar will be open, and I think there's a reception there afterwards, which just means they'll leave the bar open so they can make a little more money.
Okay.
Well, for anybody who was not at the reading last night and doesn't know Charles Bernstein, this is Charles, and here from Buffalo, New York, and going to speak on something to do with New American Poetics.
Right.
I'm going to read an essay called The Second War, World War II, The Second War in Postmodern Memory. And it was based on a talk that I did at the New School for Social Research and a conference organized by Stanley Diamond, who died just recently, sadly. Stanley Diamond, a great friend of poetry, wrote a book called In Search of the Primitive, and very interested in relations of tribal societies to our own. Not the happiest topic, my talk. I've never read this piece, and so it'll be interesting to see, but I thought before reading that, I would just sort of start out by reading a few poems, just to sort of get my own sound in shape, and also because I was talking in Leslie Scalapino's workshop about the relation of the new formalism and closed forms, the new push which reverse the many of the innovations in the new American poetry, and my own recent book called The Nude Formalism starts with a manifesto, and I thought it'd be fun to read a manifesto here. This is called Fragments from the 17th Manifesto of Nude Formalism by Hermes Hermeneutic. Away with the study of flotation. Articulation is more than an manner of gritting the pendulum. Down with all authentic formulation of these theses. Down with adolescence sublime. Down with abstract confessionalism. Down with empathic symbolism. Down with symbolic empathism. All good poetry is the forced constriction of feelings of powerlessness. Poetry is not the erasure of personality, but a caprice of personality. But of course, only those who have caprices will know what it means to want to pursue them. Poetry has as its lower limit insincerity and its upper limit dematerialization. And finally, use absolutely no word that contributes to the direct sense of a thing seen. This book was designed by Susan B., and each page is done in a different typeface. It's kind of our anti-Bauhaus approach to book design. And I'll just read a couple of my nude formalist works. The first poem is called Gosh. When fled, I found my love defamed in clang. Of riotous bed she came along the flues I harbored there. Scarce chance upon harangue, by labor's grant the fig of latched amuse, she quakes and bless her soul would harsh realize that none our maps could burn aboard her ship. And floral hung to lit parts cleared eyes, left like that elder hap that splits a chip, when dulls the deed wherewith else back I on, forwent all trial asleep her carousel, thread in torching teased tuned basilicon, drifting after still much breath-crested scrawl. Hence going bends each languorous thronement, when all I gown airs come again cement. That's a Shakespearean sonnet. This is the centerfold is simply called Emma, with a punctuation mark of a colon. Emma. Man with no clothes, trapped in a zoo with a bird, trapped in a zoo with no clothes. A fire engine hurt the man's head in the engine. A wave broke on the man's head. Red, red wave with circle, mirror, little green, purple, washing face. And also two eyes with sunglasses. A big circle with a belly and two knees and two feet with two lines, with feet on the bottom. And a little tiny circle. And those are the ears with a nose. This poem is called No Way. My mind is like a steel trap. Once something gets in, it never gets out. Or as they say in Saskatoon, there's nothing like a peach unless it be a pear. And there's no pear like the present. Then just three short poems as preface to my talk, The Second War in Postmodern Memory, since I don't so much talk about my own work or in there, but to give you some sense of the, for me, the kind of tone I'm talking about in the poetic approaches. This is from two from this book, The Cost of Doing Business, which goes up every year. There is a being grants promise of some folds that filter large against a head of brokered night, like flare amounting to a pace when all congealed have wasted on, or wreck these elementary stone with pipe which can't contain, reeling false with constant slivers who battled slope have clustered to a point no stand will more invade, until the testimony grinds, like as to what were then to mold, anger runs a sum its touch to punt upon, loose timber spiked for lust of trees, vain dream of uncorrupted light. It's not for reverie nor mystic bed that lies in tutored heart, leavened with the bitter spite expelled to vapor snare, goading under trample, slump, leave sure obey, no lore which risen froze a crumb to fill an even clump. No prompting cuts the salient sash so well as giving silence turns to ash. Would that permission wept or circumstance refrained for all or near so much as blinds away. And the second of these three, which is the last poem in the nude formalism, is called Vault and Volley. Come with me and amble over the briars into the fog. It rests a flurry by the slide to make believe measure, harmless in the way a doormat lay, 50 more bestride. The lovers in their louvre make no more sound than this. Spoken in announcement breaks, lids with iron fists. I never met a dormouse, never sailed to Nice. But just one time I'd like to know who took the keys that fit. And the last of these is from a book of mine published by Manuel Brito, Zesterly Press in the Canary Islands, Tenerife. The title of the book is The Absent Father in Dumbo. And the poem is called Soapy Water. You've got to be patient sometimes. Sounds like an anesthetic. I'll be the doctor. but jump up into the next available hoop. Nick calling, where are my galleys? They can't be lost in the mail because they went Federal Express. But something is always not there. And if it's not apparent, ingenuity, the mind's perennial ingenue, will think of it, rest and skewered. These are the saltine days, salty and soggy. The struts are finished, the shocks are leaking, and like the man says, there's always a simple solution, simple and stupid. With the rug pulled out, turns out there was no floor, and float flutteringly behind or in bed with what salience has no surety. The thing expressed sounds like some sort of pizza franchise, especially with the choices now offered. Broccoli, zucchini, Belgium sausage, seven variety mushroom. No grade like the grade that blew the gasket. Turns out to be slop corridor, 7 days to shapely your nail filings. Was there sex before Catholicism? It's not as if an economy of loss is not in. You can't say circulation because it's a kind of anti-circulation. All this nervous energy dissipates production and erodes accumulation. So you don't have to get so dramatic, talk about death and sex, or so moral, talk about idled hours. All that you ever need to lose is wasting away in anxiety's natural spring geysers. So let's bury that knife, and in the morning we can eat meat again. So this piece seemed to be the one to read for a week devoted to the New American Poetry and to Creeley, and it quotes from many of the poets of the New American Poetry, many of the poets who are here in Naropa this summer, and it gives a different kind of way of looking at some of that work than I had thought of it before. It starts out with a quote from Siegfried Sassoon's 1918 poem, The Repression of War Experience. Now light your pipe. Look, what a steady hand. Draw a deep breath. Stop thinking. Count 15, and you're as right as rain. Books, what jolly company they are, standing so quiet and patient on their shelves. They're so wise. We never discussed the Second World War much when I was growing up. I don't feel much like discussing it now. It seems presumptuous to interpret, much less give literary interpretations of, the systematic extermination process or the dropping of the H-bomb, the two poles of the Second War. When Stanley Diamond asked me to speak on poetry after the Holocaust, my first reaction was to wonder what qualifications I had to speak. As if the topic of the war made me question my standing, made me wonder what I might say that could bear the weight of this subject matter. Diamond reassured me that the audience would be small. Quote, for many, the Holocaust is too far in the past to matter. For most of the rest, it's too painful to bring to mind. My father-in-law, who left Berlin as a teenager on a youth Aliyah and spent the war in Palestine, had a different reaction. All these Holocaust conferences are a fad. This reaction is as disturbing as it is right. The Holocaust has come to stand for a kind of secular Satanism. Everyone's against it. Anyone can work up feverish moral fervor denouncing the Nazi monster. Yet I've been struck by just the opposite, that the psychological effects of the Second War are still largely repressed, and that we are just beginning to come out of the shock enough to try to make sense of the experience. Barrett Watton. These are all quotes from poems. I'll preface the author first. Barrett Watton. We storm the citadel under the banner of amnesia, winning absolute victory over the Germans in 1943, fantasy that could leave nothing out but the pain. Benjamin Friedlander in his poem Kristallnacht. This is the whole of the Friedlander poem. Crystals on crystal, piled ankle high, as wide as sound carries. Am I hearing it, algebra's worth, there is a wind, erases marks. I felt it on my cheek, summer's long, you can cross it. And still not approach time, de-solidified, approaching mothish mists, felled the way a price knocked down puts purchase on its feet, stammering painful clamor by coincidence appraised, refuse is a spilled constant. Refuse is a spilled constant. Let it loose. Refuse is a spilled constant. Let it loose. End of Friedlander poem. I don't remember when I first heard about the war, but I do remember thinking of it as an historical event, something past and gone. It's inconceivable to me now that I was born just 5 years after its end. Each year, the extermination process seems nearer, more recent. Yet if the systematic extermination of the European Jews seemed to define implicitly the horizon of the past for me, the bomb defined the foreshortened horizon of the future. And this is a later quoting from Charles Olson's 1949 poem, The Kingfishers. Here, where the dry blood talks, where the old appetite walks, where it hides, look in the eye how it runs in the flesh, chalk. But under these petals, in the emptiness, regard the light, contemplate the flower, whence it arose. With what violence benevolence is bought, what cost and gesture justice brings, what wrongs domestic rights involve, what stalks this silence, what perder or perjurocracy affronts, how awe, night rest, and neighborhood can rot, what breeds where dirtiness is law, what crawls below. 50 years is not a long time to absorb such a catastrophe for Western civilization. It seems to me that the current controversies surrounding Paul de Man and, more significantly, Martin Heidegger reflect the psychic economy of reason in the face of enormous loss. In all our journals of intellectual opinion, we are asked to consider, as if it were a divine mystery, how such men of learning who have shown such a profound and subtle appreciation for the art and philosophy of the West could have countenanced, indeed been complicit with, an evil that seems to erode any possible explanation, justification, or contextualization, despite the attempt of well-meaning commentators to evade this issue by just such explanations, justifications, and contextualizations. The Heidegger question merely personalizes the basic situation of the war, that European learning, the Enlightenment tradition, and the ideals of reason as embodied in the nation state were as much a cause of the war as a break from it. For to understand how Heidegger could be complicit in the Second War is to understand how the Second War is not an aberration but an extension of the logos of Western civilization. Jack Spicer's dying words, "My vocabulary did this to me," could be the epitaph of the Second War as well. Our vocabulary did this to us. Walter Benjamin, Primo Levi, Paul Celan committed suicide. De Man and Heidegger went on to prosper. What did the former know that the latter never absorbed? To acknowledge the Second War means to risk suicide, and in the process to politicize philosophy. And if we desire to avoid death and evade politics, repression is inevitable, which is to say that the death and acknowledgement of this war brings on is not only the death of individuals, but also of an ideal, of reason unbounded to politics, of, that is, rationality as such. Rosemary Waldrop. Fear smashes into my double out of nowhere, would shrink flesh back in itself before it vomits a wet night from neck or forehead, passes into the vague air, swallows the liquid, stays inside. My corneas extend along the axis of the flow, dries. I'd be reluctant to say any of my poems was about the war or should be read within that frame. None would hold up to the scrutiny such a reading would promote. But I do want to make a broad, very provisional claim that much of the innovative poetry of these soon to be 50 years following the war registered the twined events of extermination in the West and Holocaust in East in ways that hardly have been accounted for. Every cultural development I ascribe to the Second War can just as readily be traced to some other cause and can also be said to pre-exist the war. My argument is not deterministic. Rather, I want to suggest that the frame of the Second War, Auschwitz and Hiroshima, transforms the social meaning of these cultural developments. Bob Perlman, The Broken Mirror. From the stately violence of the state, a classic war, World War II, punctuated by Hiroshima, all the action classically taking place on one day, visible to one group in invisible terms, beside a fountain of image-free water, trees with brown trunks and leafy green crowns, 50s chipmunks sitting beneath, buck teeth representing mental tranquility. They sit in rows and read their book, and the fountain gushes forth all the letters at once, permanently, a playful excrescence, an erotic war against nature. Racism and cultural suprematism do not begin or end with the Second War, but they are the precise ideological instruments that mark the most unrecuperable aspects of the war, the loggers and the mutilated survivors of the bomb. The war did not make racism and cultural suprematism intolerable. They always were. But it demonstrated, as if demonstration was necessary, their absolute corrosiveness. The war made it apparent, if it wasn't already, that racism and cultural suprematism are not correctable flaws of Western logocentrism, but its non-biodegradable byproduct. I don't mean this as a thesis to be systematically argued. Rather, I am suggesting that the war undermined, subliminally more than consciously, the belief in virtually every basic value of the Enlightenment, insofar as these values are in any way Euro-supremacist or hierarchic. Olson, not one death but many. Not accumulation, but change. The feedback proves. The feedback is the law. Into the same river, no man steps twice. When the fire dies, air dies. No one remains, nor is one. To be in different states without a change is not a possibility. Racism and cultural suprematism contaminate everything that is associated with them. If this guilt by association is necessarily too far-reaching, that is because it sets loose a radical skepticism that knows no immediate place to stop. The Second War undermines authority in all its prescriptive forms and voices. The rights of the father, of law, of the nation and national spirit, of techno-rationality, of scientific certainty, of axiomatic judgment, of hierarchy, of progress, of tradition. It's a chain reaction. No truths are self-evident, certainly not the prerogatives of patriarchy, authority, rationality, order, control. But it's not reason, but unreason that caused the war. It's just a parody of the Enlightenment to associate it with Nazi dementia or to see the telos of science in a mushroom cloud. The Enlightenment was a force for toleration and consideration as opposed to mysticism, irrationality, and theological or state authority. Didn't the Allies represent these Western values against the Nazis? But the matter is altogether more complicated, and my account risks swerving into something too grandiose, for this is not a matter of principle, but of shock and grief. If the values associated with Enlightenment are undermined, this is not to remove the romantic legacy from its undoing. For if the Second War cast doubt on systematicity, it is no less destructive to the Vatic, the occult, the charismatic, the emotional solidarity of communion. There are new difficulties. It's difficult to see order in the same way after the war, hard to accept control as a neutral value or domination by one group of another as justifiable, hard not to associate systematic operations with the systematicity of the extermination process or peremptory authority with fascism. These associations overgeneralize, but the pairs are subliminally linked, the one stigmatized by the other. Benjamin said it best, and the Second War made it ineradicable. Every act of civilization is at the same time an act of barbarism. Olson, when the attentions change, the jungle leaps in. Even the stones are split. They reave. The vehemence of the civil rights movement and the anti-Vietnam War movement can be seen in this context. the shadow of the Second War, growing darker as the immediate compensatory shock of the first post-war decade wore off, spurred the pace of demands for change and contributed to a sometimes millenarian, we can't go on the old way anymore zeal. In the U.S., the war on the war in Vietnam inaugurates the externalization of the response to the Second War, the beginning of the end of the repression of the experience of the war. The realization that white, heterosexual, Christian men of the West have no exclusive franchise on articulating the highest values of humankind was certainly around prior to the Second War. But the war added a nauseating repulsiveness to such canonical views, as if they were not just something to dispute, but could no longer be stomached at all. The depth and breadth of the challenge to the Western canon may be a measure of the effect of the war, though few of the parties to the controversy choose to frame it this way. It is now commonplace to read the poetry that followed the Great War, World War I, in the context of the bitter disillusionment brought about by that cataclysm, just as we better understand the Romantics when we keep in mind the context of the French Revolution. The effects of the Second War are all the greater than those of the first, but less frequently cited. I don't mean war poetry in the sense of poems about the war. They are notoriously scarce and beside the point I want to make here. Of course, there are many accounts of the war, documentary, personal, theoretical, and many visualizations of the war in film, photography, painting. But the scope or core of the Second War cannot be represented only by conventional techniques developed to depict events, scenes, battles, political infamies. Only the surface of the war can be pictured. To be sure, the crisis of representation, which is to say the recognition that the real is not representable, is associated with the great radical modernist poems of the period immediately before and after the First World War. In the wake of the Second War, however, the meaning and urgency of unrepresentability took on explosive new force as a political necessity, as the absolute need to reground polis. That is, such work which had started as a heady, even giddy, aesthetic investigation had become primarily an act of human reconstruction and reimagining. Radical modernism can be characterized by the discovery of the entity status of language, not just verbal language, but signification systems, processes. Thus, the working hypothesis about the autonomy of the medium of the compositional space, the flattening of the Euclidean space of representation and its implicit metaphysics of displacement and reification of objects. I think all of these fundamental ontological and aesthetic discoveries and inventions are carried forward into the radical late 20th century work, but with a different critical understanding of the implications of this new textual space. After the Second War, there is a more conscious rejection of the lingering positivist and romantic orientations toward, respectively, master systems and the poetic spirit or imagination as transcendent. The meaning of the modernist textual practice has been interpreted in ways that contrast with some of its original interpretations, toward the incommensurability of different discourse systems, against the idea of poetry as an imperializing or world-synthesizing agency of the zeitgeist. Not only because these ideas tend to impart to the poet a superhistorical or superhuman perspective, but also because they diminish the partiality and therefore particularity of any poetic practice. Thus, the emphasis of the new American poetry and after on particularity, the detail rather than the overview, form understood as eccentric rather than systematic, process more than system, or if system, then system that underlie that or. Or if system, then system that undermines any hegemonic role for itself. After the war, there is also greater attention to the ideological function of language. Taking the word-world materializing techniques of radical modernism and applying them to show how everyday language practice how everyday language practices manipulate and dominate, that is, the investigation of the social dimension of language as reality producing through the use of radical modernist procedures. And this from the opening poem in Larry Eigner's great book, Another Time in Fragments. How we read it, line after line, given one look, refresh the eyes, against the abyss. poetry after the war has as its psychic imperative to dismantle the grammar of control and the syntax of command. This is one way to understand the political content of its forms. Susan Howe, The Liberties. We are in a sand heap. We are discovered, not solid. The floor based on misunderstanding. If racism and cultural supremacism are no longer tolerable, then literary history has to be rewritten. This has its primary expression in the proliferation of poetry that rejects a monoculturally centric point of view. Jerome Rothenberg's anthologies epitomize one aspect of this development. Technicians of the sacred insisted on the immediate rather than simply historical or anthropological relevance of tribal poetries of Native Americans on both American continents, Africans, peoples of Oceania. This was a concerted assault on the primacy of Western high culture and an active attempt to find in other non-Western, non-Oriental cultures what seemed missing from our own. Moreover, the recovery, quote unquote, of Native American culture by a Jewish Brooklyn-born first-generation poet as anthologist whose aesthetic roots were in the European avant-garde implicitly acknowledges our domestic genocide. This gesture cannot be fully appreciated without recognizing that it functions as a way of recovering from the Second War by refusing to cover over the genocide that has allowed a false unity to the idea of American literature. Rothenberg's anthologies represent a multicultural America of many voices in a way that explicitly rejects Euro-suprematism from within a European perspective. That is, dispensing with the demagogic rejection of Europe as such in favor of an idealized America. The effect of the Second War is audible not only in the subject matter of the new American poetry of the 50s, but also in its form, in its insistence on form as never more than an extension of content. And this from Robert Creeley's For Love. He had been stuttering by the edge of the street, one foot still on the sidewalk and the other in the gutter. Like a bird, say, wired to flight, the wings pinned to their motion, stuffed, the words several, and for each several senses. Quote, it is very difficult to sum up briefly, unquote. It always was. I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked. Does not refer to the war, but it can't help doing so despite itself. Howe makes it apparent that something has gone wrong with America by the early 50s. The whole calm of this period can be read as a repression that Ginsberg and others reacted powerfully, resonantly against. Not as Sassoon, quote from Sassoon, I'm going crazy, I'm going stark, staring mad because of the guns, unquote. That's the difference between the two wars. The malaise is not locatable as the official event of the war, the battles. The whole of everyday life has lost its foundations, and the poetry or some of it either registered this loss of foundation in the everyday or invented ways of articulating new foundations, strikingly without the grandiosity or optimism of some of its modernist sources. From Creeley's A Fragment. On the street, I am met with constant hostility, and I would have finally nothing else about me except my children, who are trained to love, and whom I intend to leave as relics of my intentions. And John Asbury's opening to these lacustrine cities grew out of loathing into something forgetful, although angry with history. They are the product of an idea that man is horrible, for instance, though this is only one example. The new American poetry, by and large, rejected the grandiosity of scheme, of world spirit, of progress, of avant-garde advance, the positivist, quasi-authoritarian assumptions of futurism, vorticism, or the tradition of Eliot. It rejected the heroic universalizing of poetic genius in favor of particularization, process, detail, extending the innovations of the 1910 to 1917 period, but giving them an entirely different psychic registration. Think of the role of the ungeneralizable particular in Creeley or Eigner, as opposed to the controlling allegories of Pound or Eliot. Think of Ashbery or Spicer's or McClough's self-cancellation compared to Williams's relaxed prerogatives of self or Stein's exuberant hubris. Jack Spicer, Thing Language. This ocean, humiliating in its disguise, tougher than anything, no one listens to poetry. The ocean does not mean to be listened to, a drop or crash of water. It means nothing. It is bread and butter, pepper and salt, the death that young men hope for. Aimlessly, it pounds the shore. White and aimless signals. No one listens to poetry. Or think of Olson suggesting his project as a poet is to find a way out of the Western box, or Duncan's Before the War, or Rothenberg in his essay on the war writing of discontent with, quote, regularity and clarity as a reflection of the nature of God, unquote. In his essay, Rothenberg quotes Creeley's recent poem from Windows, and this is from the poem, which is also in the selected poems of Creeley. Ever since Hitler, or well before that, fact of human appetite, addressed with brutal indifference, others killed or tortured, no possible way out of it smiled or cried, or tore at it and died. To link the new American poetry with the Second War in this way suggests that the systematic extermination process had a profound effect on American attitudes in the 1950s. No doubt this projects more than is evident. While the effect of World War II on the United States has been far-reaching, and not only for those who fought in the war and their families, the loggers may well have been a distant issue for most Americans. In contrast, the Cold War and the U.S.'s new hegemonic global role would be a more obvious context for the socio-historical reading of the new American poets. But something else lurks in these poems of the other tradition that suggests a discomfort with American complacency that the Cold War does not quite account for. This again, Spicer from his book Language. First SF home rain out since. Bounce tabby cat giants. Newspapers left in my house. My house is Aquarius. I don't believe the water bearer has equal weight on his shoulders. The lines never do. We give equal space to everything in our lives. Eichmann proved that false in killing like you raise wildflowers. Witlessly, I cannot accord sympathy to those who do not recognize the human crisis. The human crisis seems to have wounded a different, slightly younger cluster of American poets that keeps forming and reforming in my mind, and I find it difficult to ignore the fact that they were born during the Second War. Susan Howe gives an explicit account of what I take here to be significant. And this is a long prose quote from Susan Howe. For me, there was no silence before armies. I was born in Boston, Massachusetts on June 10th, 1937, to an Irish mother and an American father. By 1937, the Nazi dictatorship was well established in Germany. All dissenting political parties had been liquidated and concentration camps had already been set up. In the summer of 1938, my mother and I were staying in Ireland, and I had just learned to walk when Czechoslovakia was dismembered. That October, we sailed home on a ship crowded with refugees. When I was 2, the German army invaded Poland, and World War II began in the West. American fathers march off into the hot chronicles of global struggle, but mothers were left. From 1939 until 1946, in news photographs, day after day, I saw signs of culture exploding into murder. I became part of the ruin. In the blank skies over Europe, I was strife represented. Those black and white picture shots, moving or fixed, were a subversive generation. I wouldn't want to give an inclusive list of this, just of this extraordinary part generation of newer American poets, born between 1937 and 1944. But a partial list would include Clark Coolidge, Michael Palmer, Lynn Hejenian, David Melnick, Tom Mandel, Michael Lally, Ted Greenwald, Ray DePalma, Nick Piombino, Ann Lauterbach, Peter Seaton, Jim Brody, Charles North, Fanny Howe, George Quasha, Charles Stein, Robert Grenier, Ron Padgett, Stephen Rodifer, John Taggart, Maureen Owen, Lorenzo Thomas, Lewis Warsh, Michael Davidson, Tony Toll, Bill Berkson, Jeff Young, Kathleen Fraser, John Perlman, all contemporaries of, famously, John Lennon, Bob Dylan, Richard Foreman. I recognize how arbitrary it is to leave off the years just before and after, or not to mention Tom Raworth, born in England in 1938. This from Bob Grenier. Oh, you ni form itty. Oh, you ni form itty. Oh, you unit deformity. You unit deformity. Grenier calls that song. While I don't want to stereotype individuals who, if anything, stand radically and determinately against stereotyping, generalizing, sweeping claims, ideological pronouncements, and the like, I've been struck by how much these individual artists have that in common, as if they share, without ever so stating, a rejection of anything extrinsic to the poetic process and to the poem. An insistence on the particularity of that process, the non-reducible nature of the choices made, the obscenity or absurdity of paraphrase or extra poetic explanation, and a suspicion or rejection of conventional literary and equally non-literary career patterns. In short, they share a radical rejection of conventional American values of conformism, fitting in, getting along, going along, of accessibility to the point of self-betrayal. This from Ted Greenwald's poem, Whiff. An evening spent thinking what my life would be if I'd been accepted to and gone where I applied, where I'd learned different social graces than the ones I have, where some of the material values of the American dream had rubbed off. If I'd settled down and settled for the foundation on a house for future generations, instead of assuming immediately past generations, my foundations to mine, if I'd been a little quicker to learn what was expected of me, I've probably been saved by a streak of stubbornness, by a slow mind and a tendency to drift that requires my personal understanding before happening. Unquote. Uncompromising integrity is one way I'd put it, emphasizing that the social cost of such uncompromising integrity, inaudibility or marginality, difficult immediate personal and economic circumstance, isolation, feisty impatience with less exacting choices are not unknown to some of these individuals. Again from Greenwald's now 410 on election day. It's embarrassing to feel myself, body image, etc., often defined by people around me, my reaction to their reaction. That embarrasses me a lot. Zeal embarrasses me. Your zeal, for instance. always lining up poets in their poems, one up, one down, in relation to you and your poems. Most of all, I'm embarrassed by death. Death is really the only embarrassing thing, and sometimes unexpectedly these days, more often, it scares the shit out of me. Or put it this way, I find in many of the works of these poets an intense distrust of large-scale claims of any kind, an extreme questioning of public forms, a tireless tearing down or tearing away at authoritative, authoritarian language structures. I hear in their works an explosion of self-reflectiveness and a refusal of the systematic, combined with a pervasive engagement with dislocation up to the point of personal terror. An instance on the human scale of poetry, on the human crisis, in a culture going bonkers with mass markets, high technology, and faith in science as savior. While I would surely point to the remarkable amount of what is now reductively called theory that is implicit in the work of most of these poets, many of them have eloquently refused the mantle of poetics and theory, as if to engage in such secondary projects would implicate them in a grandiosity or even megalomania that the work itself abjures. While the formal invention and innovations among these poets is enormous, few of them have chosen to promote them in an impersonal or art historical way. Invention is not seen in avant-garde or canonical terms, but rather as a necessary extension of personally eccentric investigations, crucial because of the internal needs of the articulation and not justified or justifiable by external criteria. So the absence of a substantial amount of poetics or commentary, the exceptions are striking but not contradictory, more the refusal of commentary as explanation, mark a complete engagement with the poetic act as necessarily self-sufficient. Thus, a reluctance to link up formal innovation, which is understood as eccentric and self-defined rather than ideologically or socially defined, with larger political, social, or aesthetic activities, as in groups or movements, while at the same time refusing to romanticize or sentimentalize individuality in place of the values of the poetic work itself. And this is from Grenier's Rose. Not by today, but by powers of darkness at large, it unfolds, unfolding. Flowering of powers of darkness at large, I see at dawn. Flowering of powers of darkness at large, I see at dawn. This formulation suggests a relatively sharp demarcation with the generation born after 1945, the so-called baby boomers, who came of age during a time when personal discomfort with or distaste for dominant American values could be linked up to national and international culture and political movements that seem to share these values. In 1958, cultural and political dissidence would have taken place against a totally different ground than in 1968. The situation of the 50s may have induced a sense of isolation or self-reliance in contrast to the 60s version of sometimes giddy group solidarity. And here's from two Nick Piombino poems. Damage frightens sometimes. Reminder of present danger, loss, deprivation. One didn't want to view the wreckage constantly, but sought the constellation of lovely sights and subtle sounds. One could accept a single scratch, but in the midst of the thicket, the brambles burn, and the delay in walking at last annoys, and one loses patience. The poetry of murder helped instigate the murder of poetry. Looking for the root, I forgot the sun. Perhaps this can be described as a process of internalization, looking downward or inward, the root, rather than outward, the sun, not upward as in idealism, but falling down with the gravity of the earth, the grace of the body, even the body, the materiality of language. There is in many of the poems of these poets a persistence of dislocation, of going on in the face of all the terms being changed, while refusing to return to accept normalcy or a new equilibrium grounded on repressing the old damage. This can be as much a cause for comedy as solemnity. This from David Melnick's Poet, where Raki de Circe Hajft wet pubur et sukit a foruvul bith thoris tinali thodu tu tala inestable eight safawabl. Poets are seismographs of the psychic realities that are not seen or heard in less sensitive media. Poets chart or graph realities that otherwise go unregistered. And they do this more in the minute particulars of registration than any idea of subject matter would suggest. The psychic dislocation of the Second War occurred when these poets were toddlers. Their first experience of language, of truth and repression, of fear and future, are inexorably tied to the Second War. Perhaps poetry presented a possible field for articulation for those who atypically stayed in touch with, perhaps could not successfully repress, these darker realities. And this from Clark Coolidge's Melancholia. A great block of wedge wood stint stays at the star of its corner witch. A divider in pierces depends, wands. For is what I have made be only salvage? Sat in my robes, folds, decomposed, fled. The world a height now brine. Estuaries drained to the very pole. Geometric a lingual dent, drainage Albany. Where at the last stand all this sphere that herded me, my cell, a corner on the filtering world, all out here in my belts, things in trim they belt me, beg me, array my coined veils. The world in anger is an angled hole, the light that leaks from composition alone, scalded by a tentative, expels the tiny, expounds thing huge, things made be, any and its large. A universe is not of use. These tentative angles into the unknown are a far cry from Rothenberg's explosive, disturbing, graphic struggle with the memories of the Second War in his recent book, Corbin, of which this is a quote from the first poem, which is called Das Geschrei, The Scream. Practice your scream, I said. Why did I say it? Because it was his scream and wasn't my own. It hovered between us, bright to our senses, always bright. It held the center place. Then somebody else came up and stared deep in his eyes. There found a memory of horses galloping faster. The wheels dyed red behind them. The poles had resolved. A feast day. But the Jew, locked in his closet, screamed into his vest. A scream that had no sound, therefore spiraled around the world, so wild that it shattered stones. Corbin risks the pornographic or voyeuristic out of a need to exercise the images that hold us captive, if not spoken or revisualized, marking an end to Rothenberg's own past refusal to depict the extermination project, to depict the extermination process. In contrast, Charles Reznikoff's last book, Holocaust, 1975, which is based on documentary evidence about the loggers gathered from the records of the Eichmann and Nuremberg trials, presents a series of details, fragments cut away from the horror. Reznikoff offers no explanation of the depicted events, and he provides neither explicit emotional nor moral response to them. He leaves us alone with our reactions, making us find our own screams or articulating our own silences. Seemingly flat, documentary, particularized, Holocaust, like all of Reznikov's work since his first book in 1917, is a mosaic of salient incidents. And this is one fragment from Reznikov's Holocaust. A visitor once stopped one of the children, a boy of 7 or 8, handsome, alert, and gay. He had only one shoe, and the other foot was bare, and his coat of good quality had no buttons. The visitor asked him for his name, and then what his parents were doing, and he said, "Father is working in the office, and mother is playing the piano." Then he asked the visitor if he would be joining his parents soon. They always told the children they would be leaving soon to rejoin their parents. And the visitor answered, "Certainly, in a day or two." At that, the child took out of his pocket half an army biscuit he had been given in the camp and said, "I am keeping this half for mother." And then the child, who had been so gay, burst into tears. This detail from Reznikov brings forward, in an ineffably shattering way, the atmosphere of willed forgetting that the 50s or now. We blithely go about our business, busy, gay, distracted, until that blistering moment of consciousness that shatters all hopes, when we recognize that we are orphaned, have lost our parents, in the sense of our foundations, our bearings in the world, until that is a detail jolts the memory, when we feel, as in the fragments in our pocket, that we have held back out of denial. Denial marks the refusal to mourn, to understand what we have lost and its absolute irreparability. Reznikov and Rothenberg initiate this process, but no more than other poets, ranges of poetry that register this denial in the process of seeking forms that find ways out of the Western box. In contrast to, or is it an extension of, Adorno's famous remark about the impossibility of lyric poetry after Auschwitz, I would say poetry is a necessary way to register the unrepresentable loss of the Second War.
We have time for a few questions.
Well, I was just going to comment on a lot of things, I guess, are just one thing that pretty amazing. It seems so different from this lecture or this embodiment of New American Poetics is so different from what I heard you read last night. But it's also, I guess, the same in losing what you just said about losing history, in a way. And history of language and structure and how you present that.
I don't have any, that's not something to respond to, but I take it as just a comment. I realize this is not a happy topic, and especially that Reznikov quote, which always leaves me in a bad mood, but
So it's hard to jump into the conversation about this.
I was wondering if you could describe what forms or style that you would describe your poetry as. Or just after hearing the your essay. I was wondering, after forms unrepresentable, how do you find agreements writing?
I understand your question. It's kind of a classically difficult question to answer in any brief way. When I talk about unrepresentability, I'm talking about the fact of depicting various events, external events, as not being adequate to deal with the range of reality that that language can convey. Language is a hyperspace which has many different levels and ways of meaning and expressing, and it's more communicative than if you just simply rely on a visual or a more narrowly representational frame. But communication in such circumstances relies on the reader making do with their ability to piece things together and a know-how for how to understand what's going on. You're not being told what something means necessarily, but you hear it without kind of being commanded or directed to figure it out, so that the reading process becomes more one of intuition and implicitness rather than explicit kind of controlled and directive language. And it struck me that talking in this way could be understood within the frame that I've just been talking about, the Second War. But I don't think that there's a problem with communication under such circumstance. On the contrary, I think that there's a problem of communication without accounting for these formal registrations.
Well, I was just wondering about when you actually structure using certain structures in your work in poetic form. Do you have any certain tendencies?
Well, I use many different kinds of forms, and the nude formalism has many traditional forms used in a kind of what I call demented use of traditional forms. Every poem that I do, I try to kind of create a new structure, a new kind of constellation of details and particulars, and organized in a different way, sometimes using forms that other people have used, sometimes sort of finding what those forms are in the process of doing it. So I rather put together many different kinds of structures and forms in the course of a book or a poem, so I don't have any particular easy way to summarize what particular form I use.
You started out with a poem about the ocean, and I'm not sure who it was by, but that it doesn't matter that the poet's heard.
That's Jack Spicer.
Okay. I'm wondering, with someone like Reznikov and something like Holocaust, where he's more a translator, maybe choosing the words that are the most appropriate, but not but not his own words to a certain extent, someone else's words. How important is
that, and how is that different from what's not important, something else, something that is irrelevant to people knowing, people, other people knowing, where it's just important for the poet, and how is Reznikov's poetry different, or could you elaborate?
Yeah, well, a lot of things to say about Reznikov's Holocaust. It's virtually the only poem he wrote which wasn't based on English language documents, because it was based on transcripts of the war crimes trials. He used translations, presumably from the German and other languages. Almost all of his other work is based on, at least in testimony, on America, on documents from the U.S. At the turn of the century, in the early part of the century. Reznikov is clearly, Reznikov is was born in 1893, so he's a poet of the kind of second wave modernists, or just after the first wave of modernists, Stein, Pound, Eliot, just slightly younger than them, and about midway in age, say, between Stein and Williams. So he's the only poet I actually talk about in any detail kind of prior to the New American Poetry. What his work does is quite different, really. I'm not talking in the piece as a whole about Reznikov's work, which interests me an enormous amount. But he's more an example of a radical modernist poet. Although perhaps of all of the radical modernist poets, he was the one who was, in a way, the most anti-systematic, or I shouldn't say the most, but certainly one of the most anti-systematic and questioning of large structures, as opposed to, say, Pound, who didn't like his work. I use that example from Reznikov partly because it's a poem that actually does represent the extermination process. It represents a scene in the camp, children in a camp, and so it talks about exactly what I was saying was impossible, or the whole range of poetry I'm talking about, which doesn't exactly represent the extermination process or the atomic bomb. So I use it as a contrast, as an endpoint of contrast, to visualize with Rothenberg and with Reznikov. But what interests me is actually what's interesting about that quote, which is this horrific idea of the child holding half the biscuit for his mother, who his father's in the office and his mother is playing the piano, and coming to that realization that, of course, that biscuit, that fragment, is a token of the denial. So I'm using it more for the nature of its subtext, for the psychic economy that it registers, rather than for its actual explicit depiction of the child. Oh, I mean, I talk about that poem in some detail, because he talks also about he had only one shoe and the other foot was bare, and his coat of good quality had no buttons. The coat of good quality had no buttons is also a kind of metaphor for me of what I'm talking about. That in a way our overwear, our protection of reason and rationality, a coat of good quality has no buttons. It doesn't work. It doesn't hold anything. It's just an indication of some shroud of this past that no longer works, has no buttons, doesn't fasten anything, doesn't hold. The center does not hold. And so Reznikov's, the psychic economy of that poem, and what's interesting about it to me and why I quoted it, is this kind of registration that those are two examples of, rather than the explicit representation which the poem is about. In many ways, I had always felt that was Reznikov's least successful book compared to his other books because of those problems. Therefore, a book that I wanted to think about again in the context of writing this piece.
Just out of curiosity, Charles, I thought to ask why you chose 1937 and 1944 rather than 1936 to 1945, because without thinking particularly, I thought there would be exceptional examples of people in those 2 years, and I just wondered how.
Yeah, I had this theory for a long time, and I used to always tell it to people. Stephen Rotifer is mentioned in that list. And I used to always describe it as a quack theory, and sort of talk to people, at night, and say, I have this quack theory about this group of poets who interest me enormously and whose work I felt had not received the kind of recognition that some of their immediate predecessors had received for a number of reasons, but work that was intensely important to me. And but nonetheless, I had always sort of hated this whole kind of niggling over dates when somebody was born and so on and so forth. So it really took me really many years before I was willing to be as explicit as I am in this piece. And one of the things that encouraged me is that I didn't speak to you about this, but I spoke to, anyway, a lot of the people on that list about this crackpot theory of mine, or quack theory. And they all seemed to rather find it interesting. And that interested me and sort of surprised me. So the dates are arbitrary. I mentioned 1944. I mentioned in the piece, you know, 1944. The problem with 1944 is that the people born in 1944 would not have been as sentient as I would think that they, if for my way of thinking about it, they would be too young. The war would basically be over by the time they were one. So I'm more talking about the kind of experience that Howe's statement emblematically talks about, this enormous experience of psychic dislocation in early childhood and the kind of transition in American culture that's a result. On the other side, however, many people I've spoken to who were born between 1930 and 1937 have identified with this phenomena. But nonetheless, I actually think that I still wanted to keep it so that, you know, you could draw it back. But then 1930 would no longer make sense in terms of the kind of age group that I'm talking about. So, and it was striking to me that if you kept it as small as possible, you would come up with so many poets, of course. By expanding, you could always come up with more. But so it seemed to me that it is arbitrary and false, this category I'm making, on the one hand, but it's interesting for me to think about. It's highly provisional, and I certainly don't, as I say, mean to stereotype or generalize beyond what I say. So you could cut it a different way. I just, after thinking about different ways to do it, this made the most sense to me in terms of the poets and the actual historical moment that I was talking about.
Without drawing this out too long, I think it does make complete generational sense, but I thought that maybe some people born in 1945 would be, for your purposes, better not on that list because of being identified with a later generation, actually because of dates of publication rather than...
No, but that's right. But I didn't use that criteria. I used this other one, that 44 would simply be people who are too young, who are already essentially infants in the post-war period, which I take to be fundamentally different. Of course, I was born in 1950, so, you know, give you a sense of the kind of... These people I consider to be people of my own, you know, my contemporaries. These are my friends, many of them, my best friends. Nonetheless, I think that the experience is different, both in terms of their experience of the 60s and also in the anti-war movement and also in terms of their experience of the war. I mean, Susan Howe, whose piece makes this very explicit, seems to me kind of a very striking example to me of this this cultural moment that I'm speaking of. I mean, in that statement of hers, anyway, which, of course, I had read well before I wrote any of this piece.
I just wanted to know if that's published anywhere, if it's going to be published,
what?
The essay you read?
My essay is, it's published in a magazine called Postmodern Culture, which is a magazine that's only available through modems. But it will be in my... It will actually be in this book of mine that's coming out in the spring called Apoetics from Harvard University Press.
Thank you.
You could leave one at the Naropa Library, too.
Well, you mean... Okay. Yeah. I can't leave this version. I'd have to make you another one, but...
Taking from the beginning of your talk, the idea of poetics as caprice...
Right.
I don't know the full phrase, but
that's a rephrasing of T.S. Eliot's famous remark about personality.
Okay, right, the caprice of personality.
No.
And just in the way of floating ideas a little bit towards the end of your talk, talking about a poet as a poetics of a seismograph. Uh-huh. It's an interesting, so those are the same thing, but they sound different. Maybe the answer is just that you have to know what caprice is in order to appreciate the connection of those two things, but I wonder if there isn't sort of a discrepancy in between caprice of personality and seismograph of a culture, or...
Well, yeah, I mean, the line is, poetry is not the erasure of personality, but a caprice of personality, but of course only those who have caprices will know what it means to want to pursue them. But I'm not, I absolutely believe in the incommensurability of different things I do. So in answer to the first question, it's not troubling to me if you say the spirit of what I did last night or it somehow doesn't jive with this. It's not my concern to be consistent. I have no interest in being consistent in that way. And I did read the poems that I read to try to give some registration of things that I thought, would work as a preface to this talk. But so I could talk about that specifically, but in general, they're not intended to illustrate. One thing is not illustrating the other. But I do think it represents, one way of looking at philosophical and poetic concerns that I have and have had for a long time, and a different way of understanding them, and also a different way of understanding work that I have read for a long time without ever thinking of it this way. And I certainly don't think by any means that this is the only way to look at these poets or these poems or the new American poetry or the newer American poetry, as I call it. I think of poetics as being provisional frames like poems that you try something on, try a frame out, see what happens with it, see where you go with it, not something that's kind of like fixed permanently as an explanation for what's going on. It's a particular kind of excursion or, improvisation, although of course not literally improvised, but just a way of like picking up a tune and then sort of playing around with it in the way that was being talked about earlier in the afternoon. I mean, that's to me what an essay is taking something, taking some terms and seeing where you go with them, and not thinking that this is the only place, that at another time you might not end up in a different place, so. And this is particularly tentative, speculative. I mean, I think that's apparent because it's about my own commitment to tentativeness. Although I do differentiate myself from some of the poets I'm talking about who would never present a piece like this because it would be not tentative enough in a sense. So, I mean, my own interest in making explicit tentativeness is itself a kind of poetic engagement that I'm involved with.
And I think that the intersection of caprice with a sort of a bigger idea of seismograph of something that you could call real, as caprice is not real or something, that intersection is very...
No, caprice is the only thing that's real. Yeah. Only the imaginary is real. Okay.
I think
to rephrase Williams's earlier formulation. And for me, it sounds horrible to say that a response to something so absolutely inexplicably horrible as what I've been talking about, to say that caprice could be a response would on the face of it seem unacceptable, and yet I am suggesting that. I am suggesting that perhaps that is the response. We have to understand the psychic economy that's going on sometimes and how people deal with that, how poets, not people, because I'm not talking about, I think, when I first presented this, my friend Bruce Andrews said, it's absurd, the idea that Americans cared at all. You cared, but when you found out about it, but it was the Cold War. I'm responding to him when I say that Cold War. I mean, and I think Bruce was making a very harsh comment about his culture, the culture that he came from, his family, and I heard what he was saying. I took that as an encouraging remark, but I'm not, that is to say, he was saying you have to realize just how deaf, this culture is to a lot of these things that went on in Europe over there. But I really believe that that isn't true of the poets that I'm talking about here. And I think that they weren't—they're in tune with another kind of view of reality. And we all know a lot of explanations. I mean, here in Europa, I'm sure you hear, the way in which it's portrayed by many different poets who come through the '50s and the '60s and so on. And I'm just saying that there's another way to understand some of the reasons why there was this radical rejection of certain kinds of values, which are famous. The rejection is famous. What the meaning of the rejection is, why the rejection was so vehement, why the civil rights movement was such a vehement, passionate thing that so many of us got swept up in, and I wish people were more swept up with now in this very dark time for our country. But
we'll take 5 minutes and then to run around the block or something, and then Susan Howe will talk.